Now, out of all of the agricultural land on the planet, 2.89 billion hectares are used for just grazing cattle. And this has resulted in profound levels of deforestation. North America alone, we've deforested millions of hectares of old growth forests, of prime forest habitat, converted vast swaths of grasslands and wetlands and things like this to pasture and animal feed crops. And we have this incredible opportunity. This is why I'm so optimistic and hopeful for our future.
Welcome to the Plant-Based Curious Podcast, a place to explore and discover the plant-based and vegan lifestyle. Each week, we'll talk about our own stories and real discoveries, alongside our experts and experienced guests, about changing behaviors, whole food living, nutrition, and the amazing facts and positive curiosities about veganism. We're here for you as a guide and a place to gather resources. But with the simple click of our subscribe button, you're allowing yourself a little time and good energy to listen, laugh, and indulge in the lifestyle you may love. Please welcome your host, a certified holistic coach and plant-based lifestyle believer, Diane Randall.
Hello and welcome. Today we have a very special guest, Corey Davis, natural resource management, animal rights activist, and the co-author of Plant Powered Protein. Welcome to the Plant-Based Curious Podcast, Corey.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, before we get into the main topic, I wanted to delve into how did you become an advocate for environmental sustainability, since that's our topic for today?
Yeah, thanks so much. So I've been passionate about environmental sustainability from a very, very young age. And perhaps that motivation grew within me as I was also passionate about animal rights and human rights issues. And as a teenager, I had this incredible opportunity to travel across the United States, 49 states, over 100 cities on the Compassion for Animals Road Expedition.
Wow.
And during this expedition, I was giving environmentally friendly cooking demos, leading in universities and schools and things like that. And everything started to just thread together. The human rights issues, because when we're talking about the environment and the environmental crisis that we're in today, it is just as much a social crisis. It's a matter of social justice and animal justice. And weaving that thread together in my mind, it was just this profound realization. We've all had those moments where the light just turns on, and that set in motion the rest of my life, pretty much the trajectory I was going to go in. So after that, I finished up high school. I did all kinds of things, but I studied social sciences, environmental land use planning, environmental science, business, intercultural communications. I had this incredible opportunity in my career where I was actually able to start weaving all of these things together in my professional life. And with that experience, I thought, you know, it's time for me to come back. I want to write about this. I want to speak to the public these issues that I think are so incredibly important. And when we talk about the environmental crisis we're in today, often underrepresented is agriculture, which is the leading driver of a lot of the ecological and environmental issues that we're facing today.
Wow. That is an incredible journey to advocacy. It's so awesome. So can you help our listeners understand the critical intersection between plant-based living and environmental preservation? How do those two come together?
Yes, of course. Well, there's a number of different angles we could work on here. Think about environmental issues. Perhaps the biggest issue of all is land use. Land use is the facilitation of water pollution. It's the facilitation of biodiversity loss. It's what is driving deforestation, changing critical ecosystems like grasslands, floodplains, wetlands into food production areas. Half of our planet's habitable surface is dedicated to agriculture. Now, 77% of that land being used is dedicated to animal agriculture, which only produces 18% of global calories. It's a wholly inefficient way to use land. Now, oftentimes people will argue, and you'll hear this all the time, if we're not using this land to graze, say, cattle, we would have to convert this land to intensive crops like soy production, which of course is so damaging, this big monoculture crop. But that couldn't be further from the truth. This is a wholly destructive and irresponsible piece of misinformation that the industry has pushed into the public sphere. If we were to reduce, if we were to eliminate cattle, beef, mutton from our diet and keep dairy, we would actually reduce the amount of cropland required to feed the population a nutritionally robust diet by 70 million hectares. If we were to reduce dairy altogether, we would reduce the amount of cropland required by another 70 million hectares. Now, out of all of the agricultural land on the planet, 2.89 billion hectares are used for just grazing cattle. And this has resulted in profound levels of deforestation. North America alone, we've deforested millions of hectares of old growth forests, of prime forest habitat, converted vast swaths of grasslands and wetlands and things like this to pasture and animal feed crops. And we have this incredible opportunity. This is why I'm so optimistic and hopeful for our future, for the future of biodiversity on planet Earth. The thing that makes me stay up at night and feel energized is that we have a profound opportunity here to minimize our land use and reverse the biodiversity crisis. You know, one of my heroes, E.O. Wilson, rest in peace. He was perhaps one of the most cherished ecologists on planet Earth. He said that only by committing half of the planet's surface to nature can we hope to save the immensity of life forms that compose it, unless humanity learns a great deal more about global biodiversity and moves quickly to protect it, we will soon lose most of the species composing life on Earth. And when I first heard that, it was like a punch to the gut. How are we going to do this? Well, I'm very hopeful. The premier of British Columbia, where I live, David Eby, made a commitment. So a lot of people looking towards this half-Earth proposal, we know we need something like this. It's a massive undertaking, half of planet Earth. So in many places, in response to this, as a stepping stone to half-Earth, many have committed to setting aside 30% of their land base to nature. Like here in British Columbia, where I live, my premier, David Eby, made this commitment. We call it 30 by 30. We're going to set aside 30% of our land to protected areas by 2030. And David Eby, by the way, he deserves an applause. When he was a teenager, he read Diet for a New America by John Robbins, became a vegetarian, and as well as an animal advocate. Certainly privileged to have him as a leader in this province. But here is the thing. With half of the planet currently used for agriculture, the vast majority of which inefficiently used to produce animal products, half Earth is impossible. That leaves no room for mining, forestry, production of any means. So if we're going to meaningfully and rationally resolve the biodiversity crisis, we must transition to a more plant-predominant diet.
I hear your passion, and I live in the States, of course, and I don't feel that energy here. Not really. I think collectively overall, I feel that more people are becoming vegans, more people are looking at the environment. So that gives me hope. But on the other hand, I don't see that movement. When I look around, and my view is in everything, but I see destruction. I see more flooding. Mm. I see more damage. So what do you think the tipping point is?
Yes, the tipping point. Well, I think a tipping point for change is just a small group of people. If we look at all the social revolutions of the past, it didn't take a majority. most people, they're scanning the environment looking for social norms, and you need maybe 4% of people, a strong core of people who are going to make this social change, right? I just think throughout my lifetime, you know, I've been vegetarian my whole life, right? And in the 90s, all you could find in terms of like veggie meat or anything like that was Eve's veggie meat. There was nothing really out there. It was really difficult going to a restaurant. Like, I see the profound amount of change today.
Yes.
And that is being driven by you and me.
I've seen the change.
So I think change is happening, and change doesn't happen. Like, we often think change will happen slowly, and it's often this very slow crawl. And then an incredible shift. And it's about creating that foundation for that incredible shift. And so I like to maintain some hope. With that said, we are in an environmental crisis. There is a lot of things to worry about that needs to be actioned right now. And you mentioned floods and all kinds of natural disasters, landslides. I worked in 2012. The Central Kootenays, sort of the southern part of British Columbia, after a landslide ensued, causing fatalities, 4 fatalities.
Wow.
It was awful. And part of my job there was to develop a foundation for a gap analysis on how we're going to address these natural disaster issues, which were paired with climate change. There wasn't a landslide in that area since deglaciation 10,000 years ago. And it turned out that incredible torrential downpours of rain, which was uncharacteristic for the area, saturated the slopes and caused the landslide. And the scientists who were working on it did say that the driver was climate change. It's an incredible background factor. And when we think about climate change, I always think about people. In the poorest countries, it's children and the elderly and women who are most exposed and vulnerable to climate change. And even here, we've had incredible wildfire seasons, incredible droughts, which we haven't seen since the late 1990s, early 2000s. And these impact people disproportionately, which is why it's a social justice issue. For example, our Indigenous communities here are often at the forefront of facing the brute impacts from wildfires. And all kinds of other cultural and health challenges that come along with climate change. Climate change, this characterization of our changing climate kind of bothers me. Climate change, I feel like it's woefully insufficient way to describe the climate crisis. Climate change, climate's always changing. It's not just climate change. It's a climate crisis. And of course, the World Health Organization, for example, estimates between 20 and 30 and 2050, climate change is expected to cause approximately 250,000 additional deaths every year from malnutrition, malaria, diarrhea, and heat stress. And that's just scratching the surface of the change and the cultural impacts we're seeing from climate change. We're often told the narrative, the world is built on these narratives, right? That's
right.
How we kind of see the world. And the narrative has always been, or at least this is how I've perceived media, is, oh, we've got to drive less. We've got to buy a hybrid, right? Like consume more, buy this hybrid car, bike more. That's great. And I'm totally in favor of all these things. We all ought to bike more. It's healthy. We walk, we should car share, we should build community around transport. But when we look at the actual facts of climate change, this is a fairly small contributor to climate change, to greenhouse gas emissions. When we think about transport, we're talking 11, 12% of total emissions are coming from the tailpipes of planes, trains, boats, and automobiles. Whereas agriculture, for example, is at a bare minimum, 14.5%, it's more likely around 28%, or maybe even more when we take into account land use change. Some really important literature came out in the past few years showing that we have drastically underestimated the carbon sequestration potential of deforested areas that are used for animal agriculture. And one of these reports found that if we were to actually rewild, which we can do with our dietary shift, and we're headed in that trajectory, if we could rewild these areas, we could potentially sequester anywhere from 9 to 16 years worth of greenhouse gas emissions. This move alone would give us a 60-some-odd percent chance of meeting that 1.5-degree warming target, which now is too late. But it could have. And perhaps now it's a better chance if we were to do that in tandem with other measures, reducing production or transferring production to a more sustainable means, we could meet that target. It's not impossible anymore. It's just people have lost hope. But I still think it's a goal that we need to have. We should always set up goals that are the strongest goals that we can set.
People have lost hope, but like we talked about earlier, a lot of us are hopeful and optimistic by leading these small groups of change so that collectively one day we move the needle. But we know that we're small groups. And the people that have the power to do more, do you think they're interested in making change, really?
I think that the powers that be perhaps have an agenda, but I also think that they're responsible to the people. If they want to maintain our support, they have to respond to our concerns. And I think that people have an enormous amount of power. Individuals have a lot of power. Where do the people who are leading our countries and leading our world, where are they getting their power? We often characterize it as the money in their bank, but that's just a social construct. They're getting their power from us. We're giving them power. And so perhaps we need to empower ourselves and take that power back and show the world just how much change we could actually create. I think that individuals have an incredible amount of influence on the communities that they live in. And that's a great start.
For people listening that don't really have a clue, how can they go about making positive impacts on the environment through their food and lifestyle choices? Where can they start in small steps toward environmental change?
Well, I definitely think it starts with your plate. If we're going to focus on agriculture, it starts with the plate and towards less resource-intensive foods. Of course, the most resource-intensive food tend to be animal-based products. So the more you could trend your diet towards a more plant-predominant diet, the more sustainable your diet will become. And this can have massive impacts on the earth. We shape the earth through our consumptive patterns, of course. And one person can have a lot of impact, not just to the animals, right? This is every life we take, that's the whole world to that animal, right? But also to the planet. And if we want to expand that influence, I always think of sharing food as such an important, critical process for establishing dietary change. Sharing food, and not just sharing the food that you love. When I make food for my friends, I always like to tailor it to their taste buds. I like to make food that I know that they're going to love. I know they're going to love this food, right? It might not be what I eat on a daily basis, but I just want to inspire them as well. And perhaps they will ask for a recipe. Perhaps they'll make it for their friends. And this piece of information will be transmitted through the community. A great story is I had my in-laws staying with me for an entire year. They're trying to get permanent residence in Canada. Part of that, they have to spend 2 years over the next four in Canada to gain this.
Okay.
And so they spent a year with us, and they're meat eaters, real hardcore omnivores. And we ate a vegan meal together every single night. And it was fantastic. So I'd cook for them. They cooked for me. They looked for vegan recipes, all this stuff. At first, it was you could tell it was a little bit difficult until I started making food that I knew that they would love. They were a little bit scared to commit this much. Like, that's a huge commitment. I didn't force that on them, but we wanted to eat together and they knew that I was vegan. And so we had to make some compromises there. But they loved the food I made them. And at the end of the year, they said that they're going to take this tradition of eating plant-based meals back to China with them. What an incredible influence that is. What an incredible impact.
Yes, yes.
And perhaps they're going to make a plant-based meal for one of their friends. Maybe they'll normalize it. When we share food, we're sharing love. Let's make this an enjoyable experience. Let's not say, hey, this vegan steak didn't kill anything or anything like that. Oh, look how sustainable. Let's not do that at the table.
Right. Right?
Let's make this an enjoyable experience. Let's normalize the experience. Right? Food is what brings people together. It builds communities. It builds cultural identity. Let's make this something that we could be proud of, not something that we place blame on. Let's not make this a negative experience when we share food. I think that is profoundly impactful, and that's going to help create that transition when people are scanning the social landscape, looking for social norms, trying to find out where society is headed. I think this will be monumental. And
I agree with you, and I hear what you're saying, because I've moved and inspired more people by just being a role model, just eating my food, sharing my food, even if I'm being harassed about being vegan. It's just eating and answering any questions that people may have. And that has been the most inspiring, if I think about the 20 years I've been plant-based and vegan. Because people don't like being told what to do and what to eat. And the minute you start talking about what they should and should not be doing and the land and then the environment, it's a turnoff.
That's right. It puts up their defenses, right?
It does. It really does.
Especially because it's so personal. That's culturally important. So we need to be hypersensitive when we're communicating this information. Change isn't just about being right. It's about strategy. Right?
Oh my goodness. Absolutely. So can you share, we talked about the food, some insights on how our listeners can make a positive impact on the environment? Just what can they do from an environmental? I know we talked about the plate, because you're right. That's where it all starts. Because if we're not eating lots of meat, then there's no need to kill so many thousands of cows a day, for example, in the factory farm. So that's just beautiful.
That's right. And when we're planning our plates, perhaps a great point is that I really like to encourage people to explore diversity. It brings color to the plate. It's something new you could discover when you find a new vegetable or fruit or something like that. And diversity is really important, not just for our health. As of course, it's important to eat a very diverse diet to get all kinds of great nutrients, we'll put it like that. But right now, we get the vast majority of our calories from just a few different plants and animals, like a very small amount. We've got rice, corn, wheat, potatoes, cassava. These things contribute the vast majority of calories in the human diet, and just a few animal products as well. And just like we could use the example of bananas, we all know that there is a disease that hit bananas and that strain is no longer available, right?
Yes, I did read about that. I saw it on a documentary too.
Oh, right on. Yeah.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
And the candy, I used to get these candies when I was a little kid, and one was this little banana and it didn't taste anything like bananas. Those candy flavors, old form of banana, the old strain.
Yeah, I was surprised that it was incredible that the whole banana is dying and you have to basically create another strand in the lab. So this documentary was formulated around that. I thought, wow. And they don't have it yet, but they're working on it. And then the person working the banana tree field showed all these bananas dying.
Tragic.
It is tragic.
And imagine, because we grow a ton of corn in the United States, vast majority of which goes to feed livestock. Of course, United States beef is famous for being corn-fed. In Canada, our beef is famous for being barley-fed.
Is that right?
We have a large number of monoculture crops that contribute to our global food supply. And that puts our food supply at tremendous risk of disease. So just like the banana, if a disease comes through and it attacks corn, we only have a few strains of corn out there, all would be susceptible. It could wipe out vast amounts of our calories in our food chain. This is an enormous risk. So what I always encourage people to do is to buy variety, as much variety, buy something that you haven't tried before, inspire yourself, go to the local farmer's market. I found this, I don't know what it was called, I can't remember, but I found this pink leafy vegetable. So it was in pink color and I threw it in a salad. It was absolutely gorgeous, created so much color. I love that. And I just want to support those local farmers to grow unique produce of wide kinds of variety because it makes our food system more resilient. Right now, it's vulnerable with the few foods that we have. And as the United Nations often characterizes this issue, is that agrodiversity, the food that we grow for food, is part of biodiversity. And so when we think about biodiversity, we've also got to think about diversity in our food supply, which has been co-opted and held hostage by big industry. And I'd just like to say a point to that is there are hundreds of thousands of plants out there that we could grow and eat. There's thousands of commercially viable plants out there as well that we could be growing. And I encourage people to explore that and support local farmers who are exploring that avenue, trying new things. At our local farmers market, you could get all kinds of unique mushrooms, for example, and unique produce that you can't find at the grocery store. And whenever I go into the grocery store and I see something unique, I always pick it up just to support that. If they're putting something unique out there, I'm going to support that rather than the same old foods I always get.
And it's a great way to expand your palate and explore other foods. At least that's how I learned, getting different colors of vegetables. I mean, it's a good practice. So thank you for that. So as we conclude, is there anything else you want to leave the listeners with today, Corey?
Oh my goodness. I have so many thoughts I'd love to share. What I often do research when I'm looking at papers or reading books, it's all about ecology. And that kind of ties back into my professional life at work as well. And one of my heroes, Aldo Leopold, he once said that to receive an education in ecology is to live in a world full of wounds. And I felt this way for a really long time. But since then, you know, I want to leave us all with some hope because I find that in hope, we foster motivation for change. I don't feel alone anymore. I don't feel alone here speaking with you. I haven't felt alone for a long time.
Absolutely.
We find ourselves in this landscape built upon a painful colonial legacy, heartache, ecological destruction, and a society that is motivated in doing something about it. And we have us, we have community groups motivated to create change with tangible results. And we have you, Dan. Such an inspiration. And we have your listeners, a dedicated audience here right now for all the right reasons. I don't think we're alone in a world full of wounds anymore. I think we're together here in solidarity with a sincere motivation to mend them. And we could do this together.
We can do this together. Absolutely. Corey, you've been such a great guest.
Thank you.
I mean, you have shared so many insights with your expertise. Wow. Thank you for talking to us about not just how to get started by with the food on our plates. We all can understand that and get started there. to support the environment. So thank you so much. Your tips and perspective are invaluable in helping our listeners make positive change in their lives for a healthier, happier, and more sustainable future. And to our listeners, thank you so much for joining us. This is the second episode of season two of the Plant-Based Curious podcast. If you have any questions or topics you'd like us to cover for future episodes, please feel free to reach out. And if you have any questions that you would like to ask Corey, Corey, how could people find you?
You could check out our website, plant-poweredprotein.com, and get a hold of me through my website. I think it's Corey Davis, PA, or CoreyDavis.com. Sorry, I can't remember, but you can find it on our Plant Powered Protein website. It's just slipping my tongue. And you can email me from there. And if you're interested to learn more, you could pick up our book, Plant Powered Protein, from Amazon or your local bookstore. Get them to order it in. There's awesome, awesome recipes in there. We got recipe testers. We went back and forth until they all got 5 stars. So experiment with that. And yeah, please feel free to give me a shout via email. I'd be happy to talk with you. Diane, thank you so much for giving me this wonderful opportunity to platform my voice and continuing to do this for others. Such an inspiration, and I absolutely adore your podcast.
Well, thank you so much. And I want you guys to go to plantbasedcurious.com. If you have any questions, in addition to finding Corey's information in the podcast description when this episode goes live, until next time, stay curious and keep thriving.
Thank you for joining us on the Plant-Based Curious podcast. We really hope you've enjoyed our discoveries, experiences, and resources about the plant-based vegan lifestyle. Remember to click that subscribe button so you can join in on our future conversations. Until next time, allow yourself a little time and good energy.